Hi, everybody.
My name is Gianna,
And I'm Marie.
and this is Cereal from the Box, the show where we discover new facts, make new friends, and give ourselves the freedom to live and eat whatever the heck we want. Woo!
Love it.
So, guys, this week we have another fun guest. It's three in a row, baby. So we have Shika here from at Nutrition by Sa underscore by underscore Sa on Instagram, and she makes such amazing, amazing content. We're so lucky to have her on the show. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm super excited to be here today.
So, you are a student. You are becoming a registered dietitian. You're studying dietetics and psychology. And what made you want to study that?
Yeah, so I'm actually really lucky because I came into MSU knowing exactly what I wanted to do. I was like, I want to do something with food. So I went straight into dietetics, and I definitely didn't go into dietetics doing like thinking I was going to do what I'm doing now, and that's working in an anti-diet manner, working at a health at every size manner, being an eating disorder dietitian, being like fat positive and all these things that I am now. I definitely didn't come in like that. So I came in being like, oh, I just like food and I want to help people, and I went through my own eating disorder throughout high school and everything. So I came into college being like, I have to do a food major. And then about halfway through, I started to find myself in the anti-diet space and starting to learn more about everything and even more about eating disorder treatment. And I was like, I want to be an eating disorder dietitian. But, with eating disorders, there's such a big psychological component behind it. So I was like, I'm going to double major and I'm going to add on psychology. So that's how that happened.
Yeah, that's super awesome because the nutritionist that I have now, I don't think in any way she was trained by like having like a psych degree or anything kind of related to that. But it makes such a huge difference, in my personal opinion, when you're able to kind of relate to people on that kind of level. And I just think that there's like a certain kind of approach that having that background gives you, and then also at the same time, I feel like that's going to make you such a better provider too, and be able to collaborate with someone's like treatment team and their therapist and things like that. So that's super cool.
Yeah, for sure. I really wanted to have that psych background just because I know so many dietitians that honestly don't know anything about eating disorders, and it's kind of scary.
I had like this one, as I've talked about before, wonderful school nutritionist who was like, I think you should just drink like chocolate milk. I think that will help you. And I'm like, okay, sure. Thank you very much.
It's rough. Even I had a therapist a few months ago, and something happened with her medically, so I had to change to a new therapist. And this new therapist, I was super excited because she was Indian, she was South Asian, and I was like, so hard to find Indian therapists, like this will be great. And then I went into it, and within the second appointment I told her I had GERD, and she was like, oh, like, have you tried this detox? And I was like, I emailed her and I'm like, sorry, this isn't gonna work, like we're done. So it's definitely hard, and there's so many providers out there just printing out misinformation and diet culture stuff everywhere.
So like how did you kind of come over, like what was your experience with your eating disorder, and like how did you get to this sparkly, shiny place where you are now?
Yeah, so I actually started developing an eating disorder around eighth grade, I believe. I actually spent my whole childhood in a larger body. I was quote unquote obese for my age. And I was told by doctors that I needed to lose weight and everything like that. So it kind of led me to this path of like, okay, well, if I ever want to be accepted, then I'm going to have to lose weight. So it started off in eighth grade and it just got progressively worse until I was at a really, really bad place around ninth or 10th grade, I believe. And I joined cross country and I started running, which did not help the situation at all. And then I ended up losing my period. I lost a lot of hair. I just, was not well. So, and it was hard because I was living with my dad at the time. And, living with your dad, it's harder, and it's harder to talk about those things too. But, you know, he was really great. He really, you know, did his best what he could do. And it took a while actually for people to realize that I actually had an eating disorder. I mean, because I was just constantly congratulated on my huge weight loss. And, you know how congratulations can be when it's about weight loss, it just fuels that fire. So I ended up actually seeing a registered dietitian. And I don't think this registered dietitian was an eating disorder dietitian, because I was still, you know, counting and, you know, just to get to that quote unquote enough level to maintain all my body functions. But yeah, she was definitely not an eating disorder dietitian, but it did change a lot. And then I started kind of developing orthorexic behaviors, and it just became to this like, well, I'm eating quote unquote enough, but I only want to eat this clean food or this, you know, quote unquote healthy food. And it kind of turned into that for a while until I got to college. And about halfway through my college experience, I found this anti-diet space, and it literally like, it completely changed me. Everything just kind of, you know, took a 180 turn. I was like, this is it. Like, I have found the perfect place for me. And here I am. And I wouldn't say I'm in some perfect place now. Like, you know, still takes hard work every single day. But the place I am now is 10,000 times better than the place I was years ago.
Definitely. And just kind of like in hearing you speak about like your experience, and it's not something that we've touched as much on in the podcast, but like just the fat phobia, like that, and how like prevalent that was in kind of your development of an eating disorder, the sustaining and maintaining your eating disorder. So how did you kind of stumble across like anti-diet, like that kind of space?
Yeah, so actually it wasn't through anything that has to do with school, just because dietetics programs are still so, you know, they're like in this weight normative thing. They're not weight inclusive. They're constantly still talking. They're still talking about BMI, still calculating BMI, even though we know it's number one, racist, and number two, completely flawed.
Yes, yes.
But we're still over here calculating it for every patient we have in class. So, you know, I didn't get much from school, but honestly, most of it came from Instagram, which is crazy. But, you know, I'm here because of Instagram, because I found all these amazing, you know, therapists, dietitians, and fat positive people. And it's just led me to the greatest place.
So like on your Instagram, you have like a lot of like cool, informative, like little block things. Like everyone knows what I'm talking about. And like, we shared it, which is like how we like got in touch. But like for you, what do you feel like is the thing, like the creative, like behind making those, let me get my words together. When you're making those, like, what is your thing that you're most passionate about? Like the information you're most passionate about sharing?
Yeah, so I'm really passionate about sharing things about diversity and marginalized communities, and speaking on cultural foods and eating disorders and anti-diet and all those, you know, things that have to do with social justice, because I'm really big on bringing social justice into the eating disorder space and the dietetics space, especially because dietetics is literally 98% white women. So there needs to be a lot more diversity there. So just all those aspects together, I like to bring it all together on my Instagram.
When you're in class, like, is most of your class like white?
Yes. Okay. They're all, I would say I am one of the maybe five people of color in my program, I would say. There's maybe two or three boys, and everybody else are white women.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a very non-diverse type of profession.
Mm-hmm. And like, do you feel like you encounter like resistance from your classmates for some of your ideas just because it's like unfamiliar to them? Or?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. go ahead.
Okay. So when you have like, have you been able to like feel like you're educating your classmates, or do you still feel like there's like clash?
So actually, I kind of both. If I can just like give an example from last
Please,
semester, we
please.
have this met we have medical nutrition therapy. So medical nutrition therapy is so hugely still in that like, oh, you need to lose weight to be healthier. And you know, they're still in that so much. So I remember my professor, she's so entrenched in diet culture. She asked us to write a paper about a fad diet, and I remember her saying that she thought intuitive eating was a fad diet, and I was like, oh, sweetie, no, it's not. So I asked if I could write my paper on intuitive eating to kind of just like debunk that and just show her that it's not. So, and then we had to present about our paper. So I presented about our paper, and she, in front of the whole entire class, goes, "So is intuitive eating good for weight loss?" And I'm like, "No, that it's not meant for weight loss. That's the point of intuitive eating." So, and then she's like, "Well, if I did intuitive eating, I would just eat donuts all day, and that's not healthy, is it?" And it was just,
Okay, then do that and see what happens, bitch.
I was
Sorry.
like, "You literally have unconditional permission to eat. So if you want to eat donuts all day, go ahead. But I can guarantee you, after a few days, your body's going to tell you that it wants a vegetable because that's how intuitive eating works. Because
Yes.
body, you know, it knows what's going on."
It's
So,
like, how,
yeah.
why are people still allowed to teach when they literally are don't have
This
any
woman
qualifications?
has a PhD, and she's over here, and I'm like, the fact that I know more about intuitive eating and health at every size and all that stuff, and you have a PhD, just is beyond me. But
I think it's so interesting though, because I notice this being like a point of contention in online spaces too. Have you ever heard of Abby Sharp?
yes.
Okay. So then you probably know what I'm talking about. I
Somebody tell me who is
yes.
Abby Sharp.
Will
She's
do.
a dietitian on YouTube.
On YouTube. Which well, that's a topic for another day. Having Instagrams when you're like a therapist and dietitian and other social media platforms. I feel like that's like a whole ethical conversation. But with Abby Sharp, I've noticed like, I mean, she was like a Hayes dietitian, really, I also had orthorexia, really was like a good space, I felt, at least anyways, personally, for those with like eating disorders. But what I've noticed is like over time, so many people have had those same kind of comments that your professor had about like, well, but in like, what if I need to lose weight? Or like you're saying weight all the weight loss is bad. Or you know, like if I was an intuitive eater, I would just eat junk food all day, because I have a food addiction,
Right.
et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think she did like a couple videos on kind of like her stance in terms of like in her own practice, like if a client came to her being like, I want to lose weight, how she would approach it. So I don't know if that's something you've kind of thought about with being anti-diet, health at every size dietitian. Like, how would you know, hypothetically handle that situation in your practice?
Yeah, for sure. So something that we actually had to do for one of our classes was create a business plan. So, you know, my business plan was a, you know, anti-diet, weight inclusive, intuitive eating, private practice in Boston, because I'm going to be going to BU for grad school. So I was like, oh, let me create a business plan.
Congrats.
Thank you. So I remember writing like, what is something that might deter my business or, you know, lose clients or whatever. And it was the fact that I won't do weight loss. And yeah, that is definitely going to be something that people are going to be like, well, I want to lose weight. And then I'm just going to have to be like, I'm not the right person for you. But also, I could work with that person and try to make them see why do they actually want to lose weight. Because a lot of people it will be because of aesthetic reasons or because of diet culture reasons. So maybe like, you know, having that psychology background, you can work in there, and you can definitely make some change and show that you can have behavior change without weight loss, and that weight loss doesn't always have to be the goal. But some people just genuinely, that's all they want. So for those people, that's just, there just might not be the client for me. And that's okay, you know, because there are different providers for different things. So.
Definitely, definitely. I like that you can stick to your ethics in that as well. So like, that's definitely super commendable. And also, like, I know for me, when I was struggling with binge eating, like, I really thought that my solution was like, if I could just lose weight, like, it would be fine. Like, everything would be okay. And having a nutritionist who was like, no, we're not gonna do that. And, you know, like, encouraged me on working towards the intuitive eating path, I think was so, like, incredibly helpful. So I'm excited for you to be a future practitioner. That's great.
Thank you. And honestly, there are not many eating disorder dietitians of color. That I think, yeah. I looked, there's like 10 to 15 in the whole country. So it's insane how little there are. And it just kind of, it makes it so much harder for people of color, you know, Black, Indigenous people of color, to find treatment, just because it's sometimes hard when there's that cultural difference too. So we need more eating disorder dietitians in general. And then we need more eating disorder dietitians that are Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And we also need more that are part of the LGBTQIA community. Like, we just need more.
Definitely.
Like, so my younger sister had like a really serious eating disorder, and like, our family's Hispanic. And I just felt like all these like doctors, people that like, they couldn't relate to like our family. Mm-hmm. Like, they didn't understand like the cultural aspects of why, you know, things happen. Like, do you kind of, I know like you're South Asian, and like, do you have kind of any insight into like the South Asian community, like why people that would like develop an eating disorder, or like what the treatment kind of looks like in like that culture?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that for South Asian culture, Indian culture, or for Hispanic or anything like that, a lot of the foods that are commonly ate with us are just so demonized within diet culture. That definitely doesn't help the situation. And then with me, I feel like for Indians, like, food is so important. Like, food is something that brings us all together. It just, every party where it is so focused around food. And the biggest thing with Indian people is body shaming. And it, you know, always comes from like Indian aunties, or even your mom, or even your dad, just like constantly body shaming you. And because I was in a larger body when I was younger, I was constantly called like Moti, because that means like fat in Hindi. So I was constantly called that, or kind of just made fun of for the way I looked. But I was less food shaming, and definitely more body shaming that led to it. So definitely that aspect was there within the South Asian culture. And it's just like normalized, you know, to talk about people's bodies just out there, and really just, yeah, it was definitely a normalized thing. So, I mean, little did they know that it was going to end up where it did. But I think definitely there is a big stigma too with mental health, just in the Indian community. It's not talked about at all. And it's honestly looked down on to go to therapy, or even go like get medicine or anything that could help you. So having an eating disorder is also something that there's a huge, huge stigma around it too.
Like, so what was your kind of, when you admitted to your family, or like, it came out to them without your permission that you needed help, like, what did that look like for you?
So I actually, my parents are divorced. So I remember telling my mom, like, they had seen the change in my body over the, and they saw how seriously drastic it was. But I remember one day just telling my mom, like, I haven't gotten my period in 2 years. And she's just like, what? And I'm like, yeah, I'm like, I genuinely was like, that's kind of cool, right? Like, I haven't gotten it. Like, that's, we don't want that. Like, and she's like,
right.
Sweetie, that's,
but how will you know? You gotta go.
Yep. So it just led to this big thing. So my dad was taking me, I remember I went to an endocrinologist. I went to some like healer or something like that, like multiple places before it just, a registered dietitian was like, you have an eating disorder. Like, why was this, shouldn't have been so hard to figure out, but for some reason it was. And it quite possibly could have been because of the color of my skin. And a lot of people are just like, this is, you know, a white woman's disease. Like, this doesn't happen to South Asian people, or, you know, Black, Indigenous people of color. So it definitely could have been that. Cause even at the doctors, like, you know, they didn't say anything to me. They were like, oh, good job, you've lost weight. And I'm like, okay, struggling.
I've heard that actually quite frequently with people who did have like a larger body to start with. Like they aren't, no one like suspects or like is looking out for signs like that.
Absolutely. And I definitely think they need to screen for that kind of stuff at the doctor's office. They need to ask about someone's relationship with food, you know, what they think when they see food. Are they eating enough food? Because those things aren't asked, especially to people in larger bodies. That is not asked because they don't see it as important. And also to Black, Indigenous people of color. Studies have shown that doctors don't seem to ask that. And if they do express any concern, it's usually not the same kind of concern that they would have for a white person.
We were like researching for like a, you know, informative project that we're doing. And there's like almost no information on Indigenous, like of like the Americas, like almost nothing, like very limited information about like Hispanic or Black or Asian, you know, especially like there's almost nothing on Asian cultures. So I was like, we're fishing here, like, you know, I don't know how to read scientific data.
That's like another thing too, because a lot of people don't know how to read, you know, scientific journals and articles. And I'm in a privileged position having the education to be able to do that, but a lot of people don't. And also a lot, there's not been too much research on any of those populations that you just mentioned. And even on NIDA's website, the information about
there's one page.
It's one page and it's 10 years old. They haven't done research in 10 years. Wow. And we could need a whole nother episode to talk about NIDA.
Yes.
I was like, yo, I am an actor, I'm a dancer, I am a singer, I do not know science. Like, how am I qualified for this?
Literally. And even I sometimes will read an article and be like, what did I just read? I don't know.
Why is it so hard? Can you just write it a little simpler, please? Some smaller words. I'm not dumb, but like dumb it down for me.
The stats is definitely the part that always gets me. I'm like, interesting.
Oh yeah, I skip over the results section and just go straight to the discussion. Like, I don't need to know all the math.
The funny part is that the results are where you actually get the real information, because they sometimes take out what you don't want in the discussion, because they know people do that. Mm-hmm. So that's the part that really it all comes down to it. And then you also have to look at who sponsored the study, who, you know, funded the study, who did this. So yeah, there's a lot of research out there that, you know, if it's on cereal, then, you know, a cereal company probably funded the study because, you know, they want people to buy their stuff.
Yeah, definitely. And you were talking a little bit earlier too about in South Asian communities, like mental health being more stigmatized and reaching out for help in terms of mental health more stigmatized. And I was just kind of thinking about like, that shows an even more increased need for other avenues to kind of lead to treatment and things like that. Because I'm sure there's plenty of problems within eating disorder treatment in terms of being helpful and effective for South Asians, but if you can't even get there, well, then that's not helpful either. Do you have any like more insight on that, whether in terms of like your experience or just information that you know?
Yeah, so first of all, it is a huge privilege to be able to go to treatment and to have the access to treatment, especially in this country that we're in, where the healthcare system is completely broken and messed up. So that's the biggest problem, is the healthcare system here, because seriously, it is so hard to find a therapist, to find a dietitian, and, you know, where you have, even that takes your insurance. And I know I've had a hard time trying to find a therapist that takes my insurance. And let me tell you that private pay is not cheap. It's not easy to pay for. So that is a huge barrier for sure.
Yeah. I think I was looking the other day for one of my friends, who I had gone to treatment with, and, you know, for her financial situation, like getting something through insurance would be really helpful. And I was even thinking like, okay, well, maybe like let's look into like meal support groups or into like a recovery coach or something like that. Just something to get you a little bit of extra support that wouldn't cost as much as like going into treatment or like resuming with a therapist that costs too much for you or things like that. But even with those things, it's like they specifically don't want to work with insurance companies because then insurance companies are going to limit what they're able to do. So that's really frustrating, but makes it more expensive, obviously, to even receive those services. And then with like a recovery coach, because they're, you know, clinicians, they want you to be working with a therapist as well. So it's like, it's all just so much money and just definitely such a huge, huge barrier.
Right. And I remember when I was interning with a dietitian, she would always say like the holy grail of, you know, eating disorder treatment is a therapist, a registered dietitian, and a doctor. And it's like, who is able to, you know, not a ton of people have the access to that. Like, that is hard to get.
Rich white girls got that shit.
You are not wrong. So that is the problem. And that is why, you know, Black, Indigenous, and people of color are constantly left out of the conversation with eating disorders. And as much as we always like to think, oh, well, people are finally seeing that it affects more than just thin white women. I was literally having a conversation with someone the other day and they were like, isn't eating disorders just something that affects like white girls? And I was like, this people are still thinking this and we're still not past that narrative for some reason.
That really baffles me. Cause on one hand, like I kind of feel like this way when we like try to curate things for Instagram, I'm like, well, this topic has already been talked about. Like, what's the point of making another post with the same five statistics that everybody uses saying that more than just, you know, white teens deal with eating disorders? So that really like blows my mind in terms of like, just you think that there'd be so much awareness at this point and for there to still be lacking. But then on top of that, awareness is only one part. And that's on like this kind of more individual level. It's one thing to kind of talk about like mental health matters and anyone can get an eating disorder and certain populations are even more vulnerable to getting into eating disorders. If there's no actual, you know, policies or practices within treatment settings to effectively, you know, address these needs, that just kind of blows my mind. And I'm not sure at like an individual level, like what we can kind of really do for that.
Right, for sure. And I mean, like going back to what you were talking about with Instagram and saying like, oh, someone's already covered this topic. It's just because we are in such a bubble on Instagram. We're in this like,
yes,
beautiful diet, weight inclusive space. And a lot of people aren't in that bubble. So sometimes I catch myself and I'm like, I'm in that bubble. So I forget that there's so many people out there that are just, you know, spewing out diet culture craziness and still not understanding that eating disorders are a psychological thing and not, you know, just physical illness because you don't like the way you look. Like there's a lot more to it. So a lot of people forget about that for sure. So yeah, definitely finding yourself in that bubble, and there definitely is policy to be made. I remember the other day I was talking to the state rep here in Michigan about having eating disorder policy and middle schools or even elementary schools and implementing some prevention type of things, because that's when people start to have body image issues. That's when people start to think about these things. So I'm like, we need early prevention. We can't just be sitting over here being like, well, it only affects, you know, people in high school and college. No, it's starting way younger than that now. So we definitely need to see more prevention.
Definitely like health classes, PE classes, all things.
Curses to health in 11th grade, that stupid bleep fitness pal, you know.
Oh, we know.
Oh, God. Why is that an assignment? You know, like, I think I never thought about like a prevention policy. Like, what would that look like? Just like a checkup at the nurse or like.
So in health classes, I was talking to them and I was like, we need to be talking about how there's no such thing as good or bad food. We need to be talking about what are eating disorders and why they're harmful and all this physiological and psychological and physical and all these impacts that it can have on a person that are not pleasant to have. And, you know, we need to be talking about diet culture and how it does affect. And we need to be talking about things like how the BMI is rooted in racism and stuff like that. Like, that's the stuff we need to be talking about in school. We don't need to be talking about, you know, putting foods and green or red light categories and any of that stupid shit on, no, that's not what we need. What we need is to be talking about how harmful diet culture is and how it's affecting everybody.
I actually was talking with the kids that I nanny about, because, like, you know, the parents are, like, pretty healthy, quote-unquote, eaters. You know, they, like, don't really have a lot of, like treat foods in the house or, like, you know, and the parents try to eat very in a certain diet. And when I say diet, I mean, like, a certain way of eating, not, like, they're right. restricting themselves. And the kids, like, were saying, like, oh, well, like, chocolate's bad for you. And I'm like, well, actually, no, it's not. It's not bad for you. Like, yeah. you can have it if you want, but, like, it's also important to eat, like, these things. Or, like, you know, if they're like, I don't want to eat my lunch, it's gross. I'm like, well, if you don't eat your food, then maybe you'll get sick and you'll be dizzy and you won't be able to have fun with your friends. So, I'm like, I feel like they don't realize those things, and, like, they're not getting, like, the message. Like, it's okay to eat sugary things. It's okay to eat things that make you happy. It's important to eat things that give you vitamins too, but, like, if you eat things that don't eat the things that make you happy, then you're going to be sad, and we don't want to be sad. So I'm, like, trying to, like, say things in a really friendly way. Like,
yeah, that's such a good way to put it for little kids. That's, like, kind of stuff we can be saying in elementary school to kids. Like, it's not bad for you. There's no such thing as bad foods. And it's so, you know, you can make a cute little kids book out of it, honestly, but that's the thing, is that these kids are so young and they're already seeing that from their parents. So it's like everything around us is influencing the way that we do things. So yeah, it's really important to have that prevention early on.
Yeah, I agree. And I think even, I don't know, I keep thinking that, like, a lot of this comes to funding. Some of it just comes to, like, education and making sure that teachers are educated and that curriculum is, you know, screened and things like that. But on, I guess, kind of a more mental health level, like, we could be integrating mental health into schools, like, a lot more. Mm-hmm. For one of my field placements that I did, there, like, we had, like, school counselors and a school social worker, but we kind of had our own section. It was called, well, no, just kidding. I'm not going to share the name because that could give away the school that I was at. But, you know, we had, like, a whole space where, you know, we had multiple social workers that were all providing, like, mental health services. We ran groups and things like that as well. And having that be kind of known in the school, I think, increases the likelihood that those kids can reach out to help. The teachers know that, you know, that's a resource for kids, so they can make referrals on kids' behalf. So I think kind of just having a more bolstered, like, mental health department, if it's possible, because, like, I know for the school that Gianna and I went to, like, the guidance counselors, what did they do? I don't know. Not mental health.
My guidance counselor was, like, I was, like, applying, she's like, Juilliard, like, what is that? Like, where is that? Minnesota? I was like, it's in New York City. She's like, oh, why would you want to go there? I was like, do you not know who I am? And this is where your lady, Peaches. Her name was Peaches. Okay.
That's funny.
Yeah, it's crazy, for sure. I think that in schools, I mean, the problem is with policy is that a lot of the schools decide what the school is going to do. Like, the school yes. department, mm-hmm. education department, so the state can't really do much. So it's kind of hard when it comes to that, you know, those policy levels, because then there's a whole other aspect to it that, again, needs a whole entire other episode to talk about policy, so.
Yeah, I was about to go on a whole rant about, like, funding and low-income communities, but we'll save it for another day. No, we'll save it for another day. But yeah. G, did you have any more helpful questions written down?
Let me check my list.
Braille.
Oh, so last week or 2 weeks ago, Lucy has this, like, really cool idea, and, like, she wants to have a treatment center that's specifically catered for Jewish people and, like, would kind of help navigate the parts of Jewish culture that may be, like, triggering to individuals with an eating disorder, or, like, to have skills for certain events, like, that, you know, are food central, because, like, we're saying, like, a lot of these non-American or non, like white American cultures have a lot of things centered around food. Mm-hmm. So let's say hypothetically, like if you were designing a treatment program for South Asian cultures or like for Indian cultures, you said you're Indian. What would that look like? Like what kind of things do you think would be important for providers to know about Indian culture, like in going forward and like treating those individuals?
Yeah, for sure. For number one, the thing that needs to happen is we need to stop demonizing cultural foods. Like that's that we see that so often. Like, I mean, I eat naan every day and white rice and you know, whatever, all these things that our diet culture has been like, those, you can't have those. And it's like, okay, well, guess what? That's our staple food. So we're going to continue to eat it. So diet culture needs to stop doing that. And so do healthcare providers and everyone else. And then I definitely would like, it's hard for a lot of people to understand the level of stigma because there's stigma in every community, but it's to a whole other level in Indian communities. So understanding that stigma and being able to work with your patient or your, you know, your client or whatever on it is really, really important. And also being able to work with the family, because that's a whole other aspect. Like if you wanted to do family counseling or, you know, family therapy sessions or whatever, like that's a whole other ball game. So definitely being able to understand that aspect of it. And then just being able to understand like traditional Indian foods, traditional Indian customs, like all those aspects to it that a lot of providers don't understand. Like, for example, we were asked to counsel a patient in our medical nutrition class, and I got lucky. My patient was an Indian man with celiac disease, and I remember I was spewing off things. I was like, okay, well, you know, naan has gluten in it, chapati has gluten in it, this suji flour that we use often has gluten in it. And my teacher, when she was the patient, she was looking at me like, she was like, I've never heard of any of these foods. I was like, why would you have us counsel an Indian patient if you don't know any of the cultural foods?
Oh, no.
She's like, it's so funny that you're Indian. You got this Indian patient. I'm like, so funny.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, I guess that's a good thing then that you're moving. Like, I'm not going to lie to you. I know nothing about Michigan. But you're moving to a school, you're going to continue studying in like a more urban setting. So I think that'll be kind of cool to see the contrast between like the types of teachers you have now and like the more diversity, hopefully, that you'll encounter, fingers crossed, in Boston.
Well, it sounds really painful.
Because I've been like in the Detroit area. So I've actually been in a really diverse area my whole life, except for maybe when I was younger. And that's, I didn't even go into it, but living in a predominantly white area as a larger bodied South Asian child definitely didn't help any of my situations. So that definitely was a whole nother thing that I didn't even get a chance to go into. But I actually, MSU, the college I'm at now, is pretty diverse. And, you know, the Detroit area, Canton, Michigan, where I'm at now is, you know, it's a pretty diverse area as well. So I'm super excited to live in a city, actually, because I love the city and I've never actually had a chance to live in the city. I've always been.
I highly recommend it.
Yeah.
I highly recommend it. I'm not Boston. I don't know anything about Boston either.
Never been there.
If you like cannoli, I one time went to this place called the Cannoli King in Boston and they have a million cannoli flavors and you should definitely try them.
Wow. Oh my God, I love that. I love dessert. So
brilliant. I'm just taking a second to like kind of reflect on some of the information that you're sharing, and I definitely heard like cultural competency being a huge issue, which as someone getting my master's in social work, that really the onus is on the clinician, the practitioner, the dietitian. So it's unfortunate that you've had to kind of do a lot of legwork, it seems like, for your classes, for your professors even. So that's a lot.
Yeah, it definitely has been. There are some days that it's just like that one situation that I talked about earlier with my professor. I was not well for maybe a day or two after, because I was just like, I cannot believe that happened. I was talking about it in therapy and everything.
Yeah.
But then like there are other days where I will come on and I'll talk about how, you know, weight stigma and is a systemic issue towards larger body people, like fat phobia is a systemic issue. And people will come after me or text me after class and be like, thank you for talking about that. Because, you know, like a lot of people are scared and a lot of people believe in this stuff, but they just don't, aren't able to speak on it in class. So I can kind of like that voice right now for those people that don't have the confidence yet to come out. And then people will text me and just let me know that, you know, they agreed with what I just say. So it's really nice to know that I am planting these seeds in there, and I might not be able to go on a whole entire lecture about it in class, but just putting that little thing just in there just for people to think about, I think is really important.
I love that for you. That's amazing.
Is there like anything else that you like want to talk about, or like something you're super like passionate, or a project that you're like putting out that you want people to know about, like before we like wrap this thing up?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just super, super passionate about bringing more diversity into dietetics. It's just something that means so much to me. So I'm really involved with diversified dietetics, and something I've been really thinking about for a while. And I feel like I have all these ideas, but sometimes I just, so much is going on that I don't have time to execute them. But something I would love to do is start kind of like an organization for South Asians in dietetics, and kind of maybe branch it from diversified dietetics or something like that. So maybe starting a nonprofit or something like that. So that's something I would really love to do.
That would be super
Thank
awesome.
You. Yeah.
I can't wait yeah. to see it.
Thank you. And I'm joining the Boston Alliance of Diversity and Dietetics when I go to BU. So hoping to do that, hoping to do some research in eating disorders and continue, and hopefully one day get my PhD or something like that. So I have a lot of
You're so ambitious. I love it. I love it. We need it for sure.
Yeah, I'm super excited. And I'm so happy that I was able to be here and talk to you guys today.
Also, like, just so like everyone knows, because like this is a podcast, but like she is so cute. Gorgeous lady. You should make a TikTok. I feel like I could listen to your voice too.
I was thinking the same thing. I was like, you have a perfect voice for this.
I have so much trouble just keeping up with my Instagram. I don't know.
That's so
but
valid.
But maybe in the summer, because I have this one summer between undergrad and grad school that I can use to hopefully relax and just do what I want. So we'll see.
Yes, you deserve
Thank
that.
Thank you.
Awesome. So like where remind people of your Insta, like where else can they find you?
Yeah, so you like you said, you can find me on my Instagram at nutrition_SA. So you can find me there. And then I also have a LinkedIn that you could find me on. And I also have Facebook and all those other things. And you can always email me. So if you want to add that in there somewhere, you can always
Yeah, we'll add that in the show notes.
Yeah, or you can DM me on Instagram or whatever. I will get back to you as soon as I can, but those are right now the places to find me. I'm hoping to maybe work on a website or something this summer, so we'll Ooh. See how that goes, but Yay. Another goal on the list.
So, yeah. Oh my gosh, guys, definitely follow Shika. She's great. Marie, any plugs today?
Not for myself, but you can find us at Cereal from the Box on Instagram. So you could also DM us if you want to. That would be fun. And you can send an email if you'd like to be a little bit more anonymous at cerealfromthebox@gmail.com.
And
yes.
If you are really any dance content or my personal life, which is uninteresting, you can find me at Gianna Bartolini on Instagram. That's just my name. And yeah, so we'll see you guys. Thank you, Shika. And we'll see here Thanks. Everybody else next time.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.